We're going to call the Special Committee on the Resolution of Senate Bill 2022 to order, and we'll start by the call of the roll call.
Senators Roydner.
Here.
Heckman.
Here.
Lee.
Present.
Representatives Carlson.
Here.
Hogan.
Here.
Vigasa.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, all members are present.
Thank you. At this time, first of all, Senator Holmberg will make a couple of comments about the overall procedure. I will make some comments, and Representative Carlson will make some comments before we start on to the agenda. So with that, Senator Holmberg.
Hey, I'm Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. As you probably are aware, statute does set out the roles and responsibilities of legislative management, and I just want to quote a short section. Legislative management, quote, "may create committees as well as, quote, call to its assistance other members of the legislative assembly and delegate to the committee such of its powers and rights as it may deem advisable." Legislative management has among its duties and powers the responsibility to, quote, "study, consider, compile, and assemble information on any subject upon which the legislative assembly may legislate," 5435021. That seems to be exactly the purpose for which this committee was created. The committee has no authority to bind the legislative assembly to anything. It is created for the purpose of developing a recommendation for the legislative assembly to consider if it reconvenes, just like any other interim committee. The short interim study can be compared with the process undertaken to address redistricting before the reconvening of the full legislative assembly to address the issue. This is not a conference committee, so regular legislative management rules apply, which means a majority vote will pass motions here. You do not need two from one body or two from the other body. But of course, at the end of the day, you will be also making a recommendation as to whether or not you think legislative management should ask to reconvene, and that also would be a simple majority vote, but I'm sure legislative management would look at it if it was a situation where, say, the two majority senators said no, and everyone else said yes. Well, that does send a message to legislative management that there might be problems and issues that have not been fully resolved. So, that's what I wanted to say, and let's get on with our business.
Thank you, Senator Holmberg. The reason for this is to see if we can find resolution. We think we owe it to the legislative process that the legislature find resolution here, if we possibly can. And it's not only to the agency and to the people of North Dakota. One of the things that, you know, is really kind of an issue here is we have policy on a budget bill, and that has created some problems for us. So we're hoping that as the day moves on, that we can come to some type of resolution to this particular situation. I would also like to point out that we will be using, Legislative Council had a memo on the bill, laid it all out. We will use that as our agenda, and I would like to just say that as far as the process, the first thing we're going to go through is the budget, and we'll go over that. Then we will move into sections 3 and 4, which is board makeup. Then we'll move to section 5, which is the PBM part. Section 6, which is the length of contract. Section 7, I've got kind of divided into two parts because we have subsection 1 and subsection 2. They're just a little different. Section 8 is a continuing contract if there is a rebid. I don't know if there's a lot of difference on opinion there, but then Section 9 is the reserve fund. And Section 10 was that 7, 8, and 9 would be emergency measures. So we're going to go right down that order and talk about each part. I would like to point out that this is not a hearing. We're not going to have a hearing. However, every member can, if there's someone that you think can answer a question, we will call you up to the podium and have you answer that. But I'm not going to let you go on and make a hearing out of it. You answer the question. Whatever's asked, answer it, and that'll be it. So that's kind of the ground rules, and we would like to get going. I'm going to give Representative Carlson, invite him to make a few comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure that we will have a few questions for those people in the audience as we go through. But as this all started, was basically by the legislature hearing through the rumor mill that there was going to be a change in the contract as to who was a carrier for the public employees' health insurance plan. So we did a little checking into that. We found out that the good news was that the bid was cheaper than the existing bid, and we thought that was a great thing, and we like competition in the marketplace. But our goal of the bill that we put in, which was passed overwhelmingly in the House and defeated in the Senate, was to make sure that the plans are the same, that the coverage that people expected that they had before were going to be the same coverage they got afterwards. We found out, in our opinion, that there were some differences, so we put some language together, and we added a few of those amendments back into the PERS bill, the budget bill itself. This is not, from the House's perspective, this is not a bill that's pro-Sanford or anti-Sanford or pro-Blues or anti-Blues. This was a matter of what coverage you receive, and is that coverage the same for those people that are not only working here today, but those people that are retired carrying that card for their coverage. We come here today as we ended the session. We realized that we were kind of at a stalemate, and Senator Wardner and I had a discussion and said, you know what, I'm not sure there's common ground today. And actually, it's good to have sometimes a little time to think it over, to bring it back, and to have the calmer heads prevail and to get this bill done, because it's very important to us that the legislature is the only branch of government that's appropriating money. And above all, I think that is one of the key ingredients for this meeting, is that the legislature is the appropriator and the policymaker, not an opinion, not somebody else's view of how they think it'll work. And that's why we're back here today. I'm looking forward to an open discussion, Mr. Chairman, about the issues. I know that I'll have to have a few things clarified by the people in the audience as we go through, to make sure that we are in agreement and understanding that the language does what we thought it was going to do, or what positive or negative ramifications it would have. But we're looking forward to an open discussion and find some resolution to this so we can pass a recommendation on to the full assembly.
Thank you. At this time, we're going to move into our first item on the agenda, and that will be the budget part of 2022. And we're going to have Mr. Brady Larson go through that with us. There weren't, I just so everyone knows, that the conference committee at the end had kind of come to some conclusions on that, so we need to have them reviewed. So, Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Each of you should have a memorandum in your packets of information. It is number 15.9670.01000. And it's entitled Senate Bill Number 2022, House and Senate Differences. And this bill starts out talking about the budget-related differences between the House and Senate. And then later on in the memorandum, it discusses the other sections of the bill. And Jennifer Clark from our legal staff will go through those sections. But starting out going through the budget-related differences, first for the Retirement and Investment Office, the only change related to the amount that was budgeted for the health insurance premium increase. Otherwise, there were no other differences between the House and Senate versions. And then going into the PERS budget, there were three major differences. And if you turn to Appendix B of your memorandum, it summarizes those differences. And it also provides information regarding the tentative conference committee version of the bill. So going down the changes for PERS, you can see that the first items relate to the salary increase and the health insurance increase. There were some slight adjustments there. And then the major differences start about halfway down on the page. The first major difference relates to a chief financial officer position. The Senate had added the position, the House had removed it, and then in the conference committee version it was added back. The next item relates to a benefit support position, and that is due to increased retirees and increased workload. There was a request to increase an existing .5 FTE position to a full 1 FTE position. The Senate had added that half FTE in related funding. The House removed it, and then in the conference committee version, that half FTE in related funding was added back. And finally, the last major change related to temporary support and the portability of the retiree health credit. In the Senate version, there was $302,000 added for temporary support positions. The House had reduced that amount to $102,000, and then in the conference committee tentative version, there was $122,000 provided for temporary support positions, $43,000 was added for the portability of the retiree health credit, and then there was one-time funding added of $100,000 for temporary salaries. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll pause there if there are any questions regarding the PERS budget.
Okay, committee members, any questions for Mr. Larson on the budget and those things he's discussed right now? If not, is there anything else that's...
Mr. Chairman, the only other item I'll note is that attached as Appendix C is a copy of the Statement of Purpose of Amendment for the tentative conference committee version. Otherwise, that summarizes my, or completes my comments.
All right. Again, any comments, any questions? If not, we'll move into Sections 3 and 4, and Jennifer Clark will go through them with us, and then we will ask questions. Jennifer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, and as Brady had mentioned, we're working off of that, the version of the bill that came out of the House. So if you go to Sections 3 and 4, what these two provisions do is they change the membership of the PERS Retirement Board. We remove two members.
Mr. Chairman, when you're referring to the bill, we have some copies of the bill. What is the number? Is that version 4,000 or 3,000?
Mr. Senator, Senator Holmberg, I think if you look at your markup, that is 02023.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Senator Holmberg, do you find it? Okay. Okay. Okay, continue.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Holmberg, you'll note that as when we look at this version, your Christmas tree version, everything we're going to discuss from here on in is newly added information. So this wasn't in the appropriation before it went to the second house. Okay, so as we're looking at Sections 3 and 4, like I said, we're changing the membership of the PERS board here. Right now they sit at 7 members. We're going to change it to 9. We're going to accomplish that by adding 4 legislative members, removing 2 executive members. Section 3 is a cross-reference change we need to make. If you're going to change the membership of the board, we need to make this revision in Section 3. The substance of this change is in Section 4. We talk about adding those 4 members. We've got the majority leader of the House, the majority leader of the Senate, and then 2 members of the Legislative Assembly appointed by the Chairman of the Legislative Management. The way this is written is you've got a majority member and a minority member that will be covered. As an aside, if you do decide to move forward on this concept, I've got some alternative language you can use. This works out just fine the way with the membership of your House and Senate right now. If at some date in the future you have your chambers with different parties, we can change this language a bit to better address that. So if we get to that point, I can assist you in doing that. And then, as I'd mentioned, we're adding those 4 members, and then we'd be removing the Attorney General or their designee and the State Health Officer. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to pause there?
I would. All right. It is open for discussion on this particular item. Committee members, any questions, any comments? Representative Carlson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This was put in, obviously, for a reason. And one of the first reasons is the health officer, the person who was sitting on the board was not the health officer. So if you're following the letter of the law, they were in violation anyway, because it was not Mr. Dwelly that sat on the board. It was his financial officer. So if we were playing hardball, we'd say that's true. But the question arises, this is the group that regulates the hospitals, regulates all the facilities that are being, that are providing these services that are being paid reimbursement. It seems very odd to me that you would put that person on there who is also a regulator to sit on the board to be a, also a voting member on those particular issues. The second one is the Attorney General or his designee. The Attorney General just recently did an opinion on this very budget, and I'm sure there was a slight conflict in his office because his Assistant Attorney General was the one who was in, was led a lot of this change in the healthcare system. So if push came to shove and we wanted to have some litigation, who does he pick? Does he pick the PERS board or does he pick the legislature? I think it puts him in a very unusual and in a real questionable situation. So that was our logic for taking those two off of there. We don't think that a regulator should sit on the PERS board that's regulating the very industry that he's voting on policies on. And the second one, we have an Attorney General whose job is to defend us, who is also making decisions and could have the opportunity to sue us if in fact he didn't like some of the decisions we made on there. So we thought that those two people should be removed. And whether that number is two people or four people is not important to us. But what is important to us is that those two people be removed from the situation, and a couple legislators, by the way, who fund this whole project and who fund all of the health insurance, and we think they should be having an active participation part in this. We should not hear about these type of things in coffee conversation in the cafeteria that we're going to have a rebid and we're changing providers. We should be involved in that, as we are the payer of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars annually for those premiums. So that was the logic, Mr. Chairman. We have a little fudge room that we could work with on this one, but we do believe that those two people do not belong on that board in the future.
Okay. Committee members, any more comments?
I would like to ask a question of is the chairman of the Employee Benefits Committee, Dick Dever, Senator Dever, is he here? I'd like to ask a question. Would you come to the mic? No option. I just have one question. Was your committee informed about the bidding of the health insurance?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the process, PERS began putting that together in March of 2014, and that the bid process was begun then later in the fall. And there were some glitches. They bid it, they rebid it, and they did provide a couple of different reports to the Employee Benefits Committee. One of the concerns that I've heard expressed is that the Employee Benefits Committee did not do due diligence in following up on that, and obviously did not provide the kind of scrutiny that has taken place since then. One of the problems with that is the bid process is a process. It's not a bid opening like a building project or something. It's a process where they begin that and then negotiate with both organizations, and it's confidential. We don't have the ability in the Employee Benefits Committee to keep that confidential. So that's why the Employee Benefits Committee did not provide that additional scrutiny. The PERS board does that.
Well, my second question would be, is there any way we could do that so that the public employee...
One of the provisions, Mr. Chairman...
Employees Benefit could weigh in on this? We could do it that way? Because we are in charge of retirements and employee benefits.
Mr. Chairman, one of the provisions that we considered in the Senate Human Services Committee as an amendment to House Bill 1475 was to allow the Employee Benefits Committee to go into executive session to deal with those kinds of confidential items that are confidential until the bid is awarded, and then they're no longer necessary to be confidential. I'm not sure whether we want to involve ourselves to that extent or if that should be the responsibility of the PERS board.
Okay. Anybody else have a question? Okay, thank you, Senator.
And Mr. Chairman, I maybe should have, for the record, mentioned my name is Dick Dever, Senator from District 32, Chairman of Employee Benefits.
Okay, thank you. Well, one of the things that I would just say, as far as putting people from the legislature on the PERS board, number one, when it was set up, it was to keep the politics out of it. And up until, well, I think they've done a good job. They've actually done a good job. It's just that some were concerned about changing carriers. For years, the legislature wanted somebody to compete for the contract with PERS for the health insurance. And now we got it, and now all of a sudden we're concerned. And I think the board has done a good job. So I guess going forward, I think we can take a good look at it, but I don't know if we had enough time to really take a look at it and if this is the best way putting people on. I would like to also think that the employees benefit group should probably be more involved in it if it happens again, because that has been our vehicle over the years, and they've done a good job, especially with the retirement plan. So anyway, I guess we're not real crazy about adding more people too. You make some good points about the people on there, but I think that I would want a little more study on that to see whether we should take them off. Why were they put on there in the first place? There's things like that that we need to find out. So anyone else have any comments on that particular part? Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Chairman Wardner. A question that was raised to me that I don't know the answer of, is there any potential conflict of interest in having legislators managing investment issues? Is that a conflict between the administrative and the legislative branch? Or is that, and that was a question that was asked of me and I didn't know the answer.
Well, I can't answer. Is there anyone here that can? I don't know if we got anybody in the room that can answer that.
Just, but it was a question that was asked.
Well, that would be one of the things that you'd want to study and take a look at and dig into it before you make the commitment to put legislators on. And who knows, maybe after a study we find out that it's the right thing to do. But we do have other boards and commissions that we don't have legislators on, and we're told that that's part of the executive branch and that we need to stay out of there. It looks like we tell the executive branch, you stay out of our business. And so it's kind of a two-way street. So Representative Carlson.
Just one more comment, Mr. Chairman. The difference here is that this is the public employees retirement system funded by the taxpayers in North Dakota. This isn't funded by imaginary dollars. This is tax dollars that we fund it with. And it's our responsibility to do due diligence on all of those tax dollars. Every one of them. Doesn't make any difference who it is. And when we're just told what we have to pay, and we have absolutely no involvement in the process whatsoever, I think it's a huge mistake.
Okay, anyone else? Any more comments? All right, we're going to move on to the next section. We'll come back and talk about that. Section 5. Jennifer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so now we're on Section 5. This is kind of a standalone section. It creates a new section of law in the chapter of law relating to PERS health insurance, uniform group insurance policies. Specifically, this relates to our health insurance, our uniform group health insurance. As our plans are written now, we've got a medical hospital plan, and we recognize that the pharmacy piece can be separate or can be included in that medical piece. Essentially, what this says is, regardless of how that's been bid out, if the pharmacy piece is being provided through a third-party operator, such as a PBM, we've got a way to address that here. I'm going to go through it by subsections. Subsection 1 says that PERS board, once every 2 years, would need to direct the state auditor to complete a financial and healthcare analysis of that prescriptive drug coverage piece. And then we've got subdivisions A through E set out the specifics of what that analysis needs to include. And Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go? Personally, I don't have any experience to go into detail, but we can walk through what those provisions are.
Yeah, go ahead with those provisions.
Okay. So we've got, in piecing it together, my understanding is the pharmacy piece, there are incentives that PBM uses, that pharmacy benefit manager uses, to decrease costs and to manage that care. So we're setting out elements that need to be included in that analysis. And that includes analysis of costs, comparing the brand name versus generic. It includes the costs by provider, whether it's through a specialty drug pharmacy or through the PBM. It also includes an analysis of rebates and other financial benefits. And then as we look at the analysis, also looking at the effectiveness of some of these incentive programs. Are they effective in doing what they seek to do? And then also evaluation and recommendations regarding the refill practices. So that takes care of subsection one. You've got to have at least every 2 years a requirement that there be a financial and healthcare analysis of that pharmacy piece.
Okay.
Does that mean an audit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think it was intentionally not called an audit, although it is being contracted through the state auditor. Okay, so.
The pharmacy budget managers, any comments, any questions on that?
Chairman?
Senator Heckman.
Mr. Chairman, does the PERS board audit any of this information right now or gather any of this information?
I will have Mr. Collins come to the mic.
It's Bob Collins with the Public Employees Retirement System. We've done one audit in the past. Keep in mind that the PERS plan is a fully insured plan. So we, as a fully insured plan, we have a single contract with a carrier. If we were a self-insured plan, we would have, and we did bid it out this way this time, we do not have a contract with a PBM because our contract, as a self-insured plan, you would have a direct contractual relationship with the PBM. As a fully insured plan where all the risk is transferred to one carrier, that carrier is the one that has the contract. We do not have a direct contract. So, you know, that becomes one of the issues in trying to do an audit is it's wrapped up into their contracts and ability to access their contracts and all those things. It's not a clear relationship, so.
Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, it's Barb, so that the new insurance carrier would have a secondary contract with the PBM to provide those, and is that the way it's set up?
Yes, right now, it's the way it's always been set up. As a fully insured plan with Blue Cross Blue Shield. We have a contract today with Blue Cross Blue Shield to provide this set of services, including prescription drug services, and then they have a contract with Prime Therapeutics. And they let that contract, they make the determination. Now underneath Sanford, same arrangement, except their contract is with a company called Express Scripts.
So when you had the contract for the PBM, do you have these kind of parameters in it?
We've never had a direct contract with.
I thought you said you did when you were the.
No, I was saying when you're self-insured, you would probably have a direct contract. Since I've been at PERS, we've always been underneath this modified, fully insured contract relationship where the risk is transferred to the carrier.
So the current carrier doesn't have these kind of parameters that are outlined anywhere other than the contract between them and that provider?
Yes. Not with us. And keep in mind that we also run a Part D program. Part D is the Medicare side of it. So that's a little bit different relationship, but then, you know, all of that's set up underneath Medicare. And that's just for our retiree group.
Okay, anyone else have any questions? Representative Vigasau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I don't have a question for Barb, but
go ahead.
Just a comment. You know, over the sessions, we've had several bills in our IBL committees concerning PBMs. And we know that there's large rebates and discounts that can be negotiated from the pharmaceuticals to the insurance carriers, and I think the House's perspective was if there are those substantial discounts in this particular plan, that we would like to see those looked at, and if it could be passed along to the policyholders and the state as a savings, rather than just retained by the carrier, would be beneficial to our state as far as being able to save funds and pass along good benefits as well. So I think that's why the House wanted to include that, so that we could take a look at what discounts and premium reductions could be passed along to our policyholders.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Lee?
Mr. Chairman, maybe to Barb again, if there are savings with that PBM, isn't that reflected in the premiums that we're paying anyway, and that may end up in the reserve fund?
Our contracts with Blue Cross Blue Shield that we've had in the past and the one that we now have with Sanford says that to the extent there are rebates, that those get credited back to our accounts. So we get approximately $250,000 a quarter in rebates that get credited back, and then they're subject to the overall reconciliation at the end of the contract. So if we have a gain, then those are part of our gain that comes back to us. So we get about a million a year in rebates at this point.
Okay, thank you. I would like to just make, Representative Vigasau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's precisely why I think it's appropriate to take a look at that, to make sure that those discounts and rebates are being passed along to the state of North Dakota.
Well, my comments would be, first of all, I think, you know, what you're looking at is honorable and something that we need to do. The only thing in this particular case, this particular part was put into the bill without a hearing, and I think we should take a look at this. I think we should take a look at it and see if we can and put more money back into the fund. But again, I think this is something that we need to take a look at and have a full-fledged hearing on it, and make sure that we have all our I's dotted and T's crossed when we do it. So from our standpoint, we think that this particular issue is may have merit, but right now we're not sure that it's going to do what it's supposed to do. And so we would, again, the Senate would not want it in there. Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Chairman Wardner. I think during the conference committee there was extensive discussion about the timing of this. That because it's a contract, the PBM will begin July 1st, and that, in fact, the data on that really won't be available at least for a year, because it takes so long, you know, from processing your insurance bills, how long it takes to get reimbursement information. And the data to audit won't really be available for at least 12 months, if not 15 months. So the timing of doing this review, we won't have data to review in the first 6 to 12 months. And so the timing, I think, is a major problem. And so that's one of my concerns. I think it's a critical issue, though, and I think it's something we should study. And I support but the mechanism to do it is what I'm a little uncomfortable with.
Thank you. And I would like to just point out that I have read a document where someone feel that we're probably not getting all we could in North Dakota. And I can't dispute it or say that it's right, but I do think that we do need to take a look at it and see if we can do better. We can always do better, but I guess I think this is the wrong place to do it at this time. And I think as we move forward, absolutely, I think that this needs to be looked at and studied. Any more comments?
Representative Vigasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I could ask Barb, and you said that, I'm sorry, but what, when was that one PBM audit done? What do you call, what year that would have been?
About 4 years ago.
Okay, thank you.
I'll double check it, but it was a while ago.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hogan.
And Barb, what were the results of that audit, and did it result in any changes?
The primary purpose of the audit was to take a look at, you know, whether we were getting the rebates that we should, and the conclusion was that were based upon the access to the contracts they had, and incidentally, they were given good access to the contracts. But the other issue that comes about there is that that information is confidential, and of course, then, you know, it was confidential for the auditors to look at, and we didn't get a direct look at it.
May I continue?
You may continue.
So then that audit was initiated by the PERS board themselves? Is
yes.
That how that audit was done?
Yes. And you know, you take a look at doing audits periodically to take a look at how things are going. And also, you know, at that time we were in between periods. I mean, we were with Blue Cross Blue Shield. You wouldn't want to audit a carrier just as you're transferring sometimes, unless you've got concerns.
But you would recognize the need if we recommended an audit at some point.
But the issue that we had to work through with that one, which we would have to work through as a fully insured plan, is we do not have a direct contract with them. So, you know, the contract that we're going to have to, like with Blue Cross Blue Shield, we had to try and audit off of, was the overall contract that Blue Cross Blue Shield had for all their lines of business with all of it, and we had to get acceptance from everybody down the line in order for us to do that, because it's all confidential.
But you were able to do that?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Anyone else have a question for Barb before he sits down? If not, is there any more comments about Section 5, the PBMs? All right, we're going to move on. We're going to move on and talk about Section 6, the length of contract. Jennifer?
Mr. Chairman, can I back you up a little bit on 5?
You can.
All right, so we went through subsection 1. We've got 3 subsections.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, so we went through kind of the beefy one where we've got the evaluation requirement. Subsection 2 is a good segue in the conversation you just had. I mean, Mr. Collins stood up and said one of the issues or one of the limitations in performing the audit is that the state is not a direct party to the contract with the PBM. It is the carrier who has that contract with their PBM. Subsection 2 in part addresses that. It indicates that if that PERS board wants to have access to some of that information, they have statutory authority for that. So under subsection 2, it provides that upon the request of the board, that PBM would need to provide the board with a copy of the contract. And then also, it says that it would provide them with a list of the drugs covered under the contract, as well as limitations on the drugs in that list. So that's your sub 2. And then subsection 3 provides that an analysis performed under this section would be reported to legislative audit and fiscal review. So that wraps up that section of the bill.
Okay, any more comments on the PBMs after we've completed the other sections? If not, we're going to move to Section 6, length of contract.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On Section 6, the new language is in subsection 2. What it codifies is a provision indicating the length of that medical contract with the carrier cannot exceed 2 years, and then if it's renewed, the renewal needs to include solicitation.
That's pretty straightforward. Representative Carlson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if it's possible, and maybe Sparb or someone in the audience has it, I want them to read to me the contract bidding language from the original, from their former policy. What did it say before? We when you went out to bid, what does the former language say before this one says it may not exceed 2 years? What does the language say, and how, what is the rebidding, the solicitation upon the call of the board? I want to hear the language from before.
What was in the contract?
Yeah, no, that, what we've always followed for the last 37 years. I want to know what that language was and compared to this language.
Do you have that?
Somebody's got to have the language that we've been following for years. What is that language?
The language is established in the request for proposal.
So what has our language prior to this always been?
We have been going out for bids on a two-year basis with an option to extend for up to 6 years. And when the Affordable Care Act came into place, we did an extension with Blue Cross Blue Shield and actually went 8 years. Last time we went 2 years because of the Affordable Care Act, and it was only on a fully insured basis. And now we're now we went back the way we had been doing it prior to all the Affordable Care Act stuff getting involved in here with limitations. So it's a firm contract for 2 years under the RFP, with an option to renew it two times, subject to a successful renewal. Now, if I might take a minute and just walk you through the timeline of that a little bit.
You may.
What that means is, and let's take a look at today. The contract has been let to Sanford today. They have a firm contract for the next 2 years.
Now, just stop though. I just want to ask a question. So at the end of 2 years, if the PERS board decided that Sanford wasn't performing the way they want it, they could put it out for bids there.
Well, that's where I wanted to kind of highlight. Okay. Where that decision is going to have to occur, as it would have occurred with Blue Cross Blue Shield, is next summer. Because what we did and we would do with Blue Cross Blue Shield is we would go to them approximately 1 year before the end of the next legislative session. And we would ask them, like, next year, what is your renewal amount going to be with us? At the time we run the renewal, ask them for a renewal. We have our own consultant that separately and independently looks at the claims data and comes up with what they think the renewal amount should be. We compare those two amounts to determine whether it's deemed reasonable or not. But then we get a number by which will be next year in September. That's been that's the renewed is accepted that we can forward to the Executive Budget Office. And at that point, then that number then goes into the is considered considered in the budget process, and then that. Whatever number is included there is what's forwarded to you in January. So you can see the process starts pretty early. So next year at this time, a determination under a renewal will have to be made relating to Sanford. Now, we talked about the premium as one variable there in determining whether the contract should be renewed. The second one is the service. You know, our members... is the service level what's expected? And, you know, you may have an acceptable renewal and you may have a situation where the service levels are unacceptable and you might not renew for service levels rather than budget. So but Mr. this Chairman, way we have a number for you when you come to town.
Continue, Representative Carlson.
I just, as I'm reading the language, one says the term of the contract may not exceed 2 years. So from what you just explained to me, the only difference would be it may not exceed. Because you're telling me that after you do your actuarial, you're going to say, you're going to make that call whether it's a two-year contract and you can either renew it or you call it to bid.
Next summer, yes.
So the only difference is the words may not exceed.
In other words, we would not have an opportunity to renew. Then we would have to go to bid. Is that what I'm understanding? The language today says that we would no longer, the language in 2022 would say that we would have to go to bid at the end, within 2 years. So we would have to start another bid process next summer. which is not what we said in the RFP, because the RFP said you had an option for two-year renewals.
Okay, anyone else? Representative Vigasa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Sparb, when you get the renewal information, then if it's not to PERS Board's liking, you could solicit bids at that point. Is that how you've been proceeding in the past?
Yes, that's been an option. And just even like in a bid, we got bids in this last time on a fully insured basis from both Blue Cross Blue Shield and Sanford, and we rejected them. We went back. We actually ran two bidding processes this last time, because the first ones were the first ones that were submitted weren't acceptable. So sometimes you run more than one bid during a bidding process.
One more question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
They were not acceptable because
it varied. Blue Cross Blue Shield bid was too high. There were some components in the technical aspects of the proposal that we wanted to enhance as well. Things about the provider network we wanted to enhance in it. We also wanted to enhance the provision in there so that if we did change carriers, that everybody's pre-approvals or authorizations carried over. We hadn't specified that. And we didn't want our members to have to go through a whole new pre-authorization procedure if, in fact, that was to occur. So there were some changes in the technical aspect of the proposal, and there was the opportunity then for everybody to adjust their pricing.
Okay. Anyone else have a question for Sparb before he sits down? Representative,
just Mr. Chairman, I still would like to see the old language you're working under. I want to see somewhere in writing how your bidding process was decided upon.
It would be in the RFP, and I can get you that out.
I need to see that.
Information.
Yeah. Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Chairman Wardner. And Sparb, when you make a recommendation that goes to the executive office, do you also inform employee benefits of that information for their action?
We advise, I'd have to go back to see what we advise them at this particular time.
Because it sounds like last year you were informing them of some of the bid process. That you had it out on bid so that they were aware of that. But if it's being reviewed, that might be a legislative review procedure that could be used.
Now, this time what would have complicated that is that we went out for bid with the bids coming in September. And so at that time, you know, all of the bidders and the information, I mean, we don't want to be releasing to the competitor what the other person's bid is. And so this time we wouldn't have had the opportunity to do it because then we rejected the bid and the new bids didn't come in until November. And of course everything would have been, so we wouldn't have had, now that I think about it, we wouldn't have had the opportunity to let employee benefits know. What we had to give the executive office this time is not that we had a firm bid in hand, because we didn't. We just had to say, look, you know, this is where they're ranging.
But you did keep employee benefits aware of what the process was.
Well, we gave presentations this last session to Employee Benefits Committee, to the State Employee Compensation Commission. There was presentation to the interim committee that was looking at health care costs. You know, they had asked about the bid process, and we gave a presentation on that to them. So, you know, if there's opportunities where we got requests for information on it, we shared the information. So there was several committees that we gave information to.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, Sparb, you know, in the two-year renewal that you've been working under in the past, if the performance wasn't satisfactory at the end of those 2 years when you were evaluating the renewal, what would your procedure be to move forward with dismissing that carrier and adding a new one or rebidding? How would that gap be covered?
Well, that's why we would do it next year. I mean, Sanford and Blue Cross Sanford actually has 1 year to perform, because we will make that decision next summer. We will get with them a renewal amount, and of course, this is one of the things that's challenging for carriers, is we ask them to project out 36 months what the premiums are, 12 months until the end of the biennium, and then a firm premium for the 24 months after that, so that we can make that decision. And so next summer, midpoint in the biennium, we're going to ask Sanford, like we've always asked Blue Cross Blue Shield, for a renewal amount. At that time, the board will make a decision as to whether a renewal is the way to go, and if the renewal is decided, then we move forward based upon that and that number. Now, if the renewal, let's say there's cause for a change, either the premium amount comes in unexpectedly high compared to what our consultant, let's say our consultant runs some numbers, and they say it should be somewhere in the, you know, 10 to 15% range, and say we get a premium renewal, it's 25 to 30. That might drive us out to a bid. So we would start the bidding process right away next summer, 12 months before the end of the biennium. So we have a 12-month, we have a run at it based upon the schedule of events that are there.
So, Sparb, you were always prepared to rebid after the two-year term?
Because we really do it at the end of the first year is when we make the decision. So the carrier really has 12 months to perform, because you're right, if we waited all the way to the end, we wouldn't have a number for you, for one thing, to consider during the session, and we wouldn't have time enough to bid it. And I know one of the things that we've backed this bidding process up so we can have a fairly firm number for you when you come to town that's necessary to maintain the existing plan design. Now, we always give as well, you know, options. You know, you can cut this, you can cut that, you can reduce it by 3%, you can do that. And that committee this last session looked at those, what are the options, and can we reduce it, and what do we pay, you know, how does it affect the Affordable Care Act and things like that. So we worked with it was Government Finance Committee that we worked with on that.
Anyone else have a question at this time? Thank you. The biggest thing that, from my standpoint, would be that the PERS board does have control of this situation. They can demand a rebid after 2 years, and I think that by inserting this, we are changing the contract on the Sanford PERS plan, and so I think we should. I would hope we could let PERS do their job and we just stay out of it and not mandate it. Any other comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to go back to how some of these things are interrelated. Once again, we're given a number and we're told that we're going to pay it. And we have absolutely no involvement legislatively in that number prior to the fact that it's told to us. And that makes the case for having some participation in the PERS board. And I can give you $254 million reasons why we need to be involved, because that's what our annual biennial budget number is. And we would never, Mr. Chairman, let anything else that big of a number go through this legislative assembly without some input.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. We're going to move on to the next section 7. I would like to zero in on subsection 1. Jennifer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I will go over subsection 1 first and then pause so you can discuss it, because sub 1 and sub 2 are pretty freestanding. This is creating a new body of law. Again, we're in that uniform group insurance chapter. Specifically, we're talking about the health insurance policies, and that subsection 1 indicates it addresses the privacy of the information that health carrier has. Specifically, they say that except as necessary for treatment, payment, and operations, that health insurance carrier cannot disclose identifiable or non-identifiable information to any healthcare delivery entity. We clarify it doesn't matter if it's related to the carrier or not. Things to point out in this discussion is we do have a body of federal law here under HIPAA that talks about privacy. One of
one of the words you'll hear in that body of law is personally identifiable information. So you can do things to that information to make it non-personally identifiable. In this section, you're clarifying you don't care if it's personally identifiable or not. There's a prohibition on sharing it. Another thing to bring to your attention is it is a focused prohibition. It doesn't say don't share it at all. It says don't share it to a healthcare delivery entity. So don't share it with a provider or a provider organization. I would distinguish that from don't share it with a research institution, assuming that they're not a provider. If they're one of our higher education research entities, that's not what this prohibition is talking about. We're talking about don't share it with another healthcare delivery entity. And I can pause at that.
All right, committee members, comments about this particular section? And I guess I felt that it was pretty much handled under HIPAA, but Representative Carlson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there is a difference between aggregated information and personal information, and this deals with the aggregated information. When you have a family tree that is all interconnected, like the Sanford system is, this is making sure that information on aggregated services, which means you could add more psychologists if you think that there's a lot of money being made in that area, or you could add more of something else. And they may be well doing this already, and I'd be happy to hear from Sanford on this, but this creates the firewall that says we haven't had that situation before with the Blues. I mean, they were not a provider as well as being an insurer. There's a difference. And this says make sure that firewall exists, that you don't use this aggregated information to your advantage over time to add in services or take away services where you're seeing aggregately that there's either a lot of money being made or no money being made. So this isn't real onerous. It just says that make sure that firewall exists between the two when there's common ownership. Even though the family tree is separated, and we've all seen the set family tree, I think this is good language for our patients and for our providers of the state of North Dakota.
Is there a representative from Sanford that could answer that question? Is there a firewall? And how extensive is it?
For the record, Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Carlson, and I am the Director of Planning and Regulation at Sanford Health, which does include oversight of HIPAA and privacy information. Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, yes, there is a firewall. There was a hearing where a org chart was actually presented by the House side that reflected the firewall within the Sanford Health organizational chart, in which all health services delivery, including patient care, clinic, home health, SNFs, hospice, hospital, are on one side of the house. We call this the house with the two rooms under one roof. And so all those entities on the organizational chart are on one side. And on the other side are what are considered our research and development areas, which considered is research, our world clinics, the foundation, which is the fundraising arm of the health system, the health plan, which falls under the development division, profile, our weight loss centers also fall under that division. Those are just to name a few that fall under the research and development side because it's not directly related to patient care. And that is how we divide this information. I would further point out that nationally, there are quite a few renowned provider-owned health plans that have managed to control the integrity and the confidentiality of all the providers in their network. This is not a unique challenge to Sanford Health Plan because other health plans have successfully done this for years. And hence, that's how we figure out how to model the appropriate organizational structure of our health plan since we are provider-sponsored. Geisinger, UPMC, Health Partners is out of Minneapolis. That's just to name a couple. Kaiser Permanente is a very huge one, obviously, that is also provider-sponsored. So that challenge is not unique nationally. Furthermore, the divisions of insurance recognize that. They're used to working with such provider-sponsored health plans at the NAIC level, and they recognize what to look for when they are doing audits, as well as Deloitte, our regular auditors and consultants at Deloitte and such.
Well, I want you to answer specifically, you know, Representative Carlson, when he talks about aggregate information, he's questioning whether that's being shared or not being shared?
We, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, Sanford Health Plan's data bank is separate. It is our own data bank. It is our claims information. That is because HIPAA specifically defines, as is outlined here, claims information is used only for treatment payment operations. And if you go to the federal language, it defines what treatment is, it defines what payment is, and it very specifically prescribes what operations is, which in generally is the quality measures for health plan operations. That is what it's used for. That data in aggregate is supposed to use your health plan information and services of treatment, payment, and operations.
So you do not feel that you have no concerns about what Representative Carlson was talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, we have no concerns. It's, in our opinion, it would be unnecessary language, but it just outlines what it already exists today. And HIPAA was like that. We all knew to preserve privacy and confidentiality. HIPAA simply was a federal law that put it in writing for all of us to follow. The security measures were vastly more important when it came to the IT side of preserving privacy and protecting it.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Carlson, then you would have no trouble putting this in code if it's already being done by you and it isn't a threatening situation.
We had testified previously that this was just an unnecessary clause, but we had no concerns about it.
But being legislators like we are, trust but verify is a rather important word.
All right, anyone else have any questions? Thank you. Anybody else have any comments on this particular part?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hogan.
May we ask somebody from the insurance departments to talk about their view of this and if they monitor or regulate this in any way? Because I think the insurance department has similar standards on this issue.
We may, and Ms. Turnus is here, so we will ask her to come forward and answer your question. Did you hear the question? And yeah, identify yourself too.
I did, Mr. Chairman. Rebecca Turnus, Deputy Insurance Commissioner at the North Dakota Insurance Department. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hogan, we do have a section in code on privacy, and I think I just lost it. But basically what it says, again, it reiterates a lot of the language of HIPAA, that personal information cannot be disclosed. It does have some interesting language about allowing disclosure for certain purposes like research or utilization management or chronic disease management, those things where there's a benefit to aggregating data and analyzing it. So that would be the only thing to consider.
Continue.
Do you have any concerns about this language, or do you think this is okay?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hogan, I think we're okay with it. We're going to examine the company. We're going to look at any complaints we have or any pattern of problems or people alleging anything going wrong. That would be of a big concern, and we already have that authority. So I think it's okay to put limits on it as long as it doesn't limit the cost-saving advantages of some of that information. So.
Okay. Anyone else? Any more comments, questions? Representative Vigasaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think the language should stay. We have this unique situation where we have the insurer, Sanford, and a provider, Sanford. I mean, this is a different situation than we've had before. The insurance part of it, the carrier, you know, they're going to see all of the information from every provider that does any work with our state employees and retirees. I just think it's proper to make sure that is separated out, and I think the language is fine the way it is. I think it should remain.
Okay, any other comments? If not, we're going to move to Section 7, Subsection 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through our discussions, we haven't really distinguished between our carrier being what we're used to with the Blues versus something a little bit new with Sanford, where it's an integrated healthcare delivery system. This subsection specifically applies to that situation where you've got that integrated delivery system. We say that
if that PERS contract is with a carrier that has common ownership with a healthcare delivery entity, then we're going to lay out some parameters for what their minimum rates may be for their negotiated provider discount rates. We're limiting this to in-state providers, and we set two different classes here. Subdivision A indicates what the rates would be for critical access hospitals, and only critical access hospitals. Essentially what it says is that the reimbursement rates that carrier has with its related critical access hospitals kind of sets your floor, sets your threshold. The rates with non-related critical access hospitals may not be any less than that. And I can pause there if you'd like, or I can move over into the other class of providers.
I think you're doing good.
Okay.
Yeah, we should do both. I agree.
The second class here under sub B is everybody else. Everyone else who's not a critical access hospital. And we set that same parameter. We say the reimbursement rate for someone who's not related to the carrier can't be any less than it would be for a related carrier. And again, the limitation that this is in-state providers only.
Okay, committee members, comments, questions? Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me like with those two provisions, we're sort of manipulating the market and not allowing it to do what it should. I would suggest that maybe some of the rural hospitals are getting reimbursed more because of where they're at than the larger hospitals are, simply because it's necessary to keep them open. And so manipulating the market, by what I'm seeing here, I don't think is a very good idea at all.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Carlson?
I guess I could take the other side of that that discussion and say you could manipulate the market to eliminate competition by having discount rates that are in excess of what somebody could provide the services for. So you could look at both, you know, one might be, and I understand the point of our small and necessary hospitals and our critical access hospitals, keeping them open even though they have very few people in their beds many days. But on the other hand, you could discount at levels, and we've seen some examples coming through that I've gotten emails on, how the discounts are much deeper than they were ever for the reimbursement they received before. And I think Representative Vigasov might have some figures on that. But so I think there's some value to it. Whether the wording is exactly right, I can't guarantee you that. But I think there's some value to the fact that you make sure that the purpose isn't, when you have a provider and an insurer, that they're not muscling people out of the business. Because they have the opportunity to do that as the insurer by the discount rates that they give.
Anyone else? Representative Vigasov?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe we could get an update too as to, you know, which providers are not in the network at this point, or are there negotiating going on with, I'm thinking of the big providers, Essentia, Trinity, Avea. If they're now have been integrated into the Sanford Health Group, maybe, I think that's where our concern is, that if those providers aren't going to be given the same discounts that Sanford's own providers will get.
Lisa, would you answer that question?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to answer a couple questions, number one, Sanford Health Plan is a health insurance company. We have to sell to clients a network that they are willing to buy. If we were to muscle out all of our competitors, no one would buy insurance from us anymore. There is a realistic competitive nature that exists within the traditional insurance market, which is we're there to serve our clients, and our clients expect, and in many cases demand, comprehensive network access options, which we consider open access plans, and some of the smaller and individual ones might prefer custom network option plans. So we provide the spectrum of all of them. Therefore, we have had always any willing provider contracting philosophy, which is if you're willing to negotiate with us, you're certainly welcome to be in our network. That being said, I would let you know that what goes into a negotiation contract is identifying what the market is, a fair market value level already. That conversation is followed up with the provider by, what is your case patient mix? Do you accept Medicare? Do you accept Medicaid? Do you have any certain accreditation standards that make you a higher quality provider than certain other providers? Where do you preside? Are you primarily in a rural area or a metro area? And that all goes, scope goes into it as well. That all goes into part of the conversation. While we are always compared to our competitors from our providers, X provider pays me this amount on this code, you pay me this amount on this code. Sanford Health Plan may provide more on a subset of codes on some areas than a competitor. We may provide less on a subset of codes than a competitor. Our approach is always that with our providers, when we're going through the negotiation process, we look at it in aggregate. And oftentimes the providers point out their high volume codes, and that's where their focus tends to be, and we understand that and negotiate through that. To answer your question about the major health systems, they are in the network. The answer is all the major health systems in North Dakota now are in the network and contracted. Essential was the latest one to be added to our network. We've always had a contract with Trinity to be in our network. All True, St. Alexis, CHI have all been in our network for many, actually before we entered the market, for many, many years.
Okay, any other questions for Lisa? Representative Carlson, did you have a question?
Well, I'm trying to understand this whole process and how it works. And I understand if Sanford Hospital provides service A and the guy across the street provides service A, should those rates be the same to reimburse both of those providers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, that's an excellent question, and I will give you an example of that. The answer is not always, and it depends on the factors that I just outlined previously. I'll give you an example of a standalone imaging center. Let's just say they do CAT scans, MRIs, X-rays, and they might set up shop next to All True in Grand Forks. And they may say to us, we deserve the same payment as the that you pay for MRI, CT, CAT scans at the local community-based hospitals. But oh, by the way, we don't take Medicare. Maybe we don't accept Medicare assignment. We don't accept Medicaid. We are not accredited in any way, shape, or form. We have no quality standards. And we have no overhead. We don't deliver babies. We're not running an emergency room department. This is our limited scope of services, and this is our limited patient mix. And that would go into our consideration. And that's a very likely scenario here. And so when we negotiate with All True, we take into account, as I said, in aggregate, what are the services they provide? Same thing with a rural hospital. We look at their patient mix. We have some rural hospitals that are primarily Medicaid patients and Medicare, and that's it. There's very few private payers. We take that into account when we're negotiating their contract, because that is the reality of their coding and reimbursement world. When you move to situations as prescribed in this law, you now have put at a competitive disadvantage a traditional insurance company trying to compete against Medica and Blue Cross Blue Shield with one arm tied behind our back. And that doesn't serve the consumers well at all. And it certainly is not in the best interest of any of our clients that we would serve as well, also.
Okay. Any other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Igusa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Carlson, have you gone out to all the providers now and indicated what you will be paying for the various codes, or are you in the process of that at the present time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vigasaw, we are still in the process of doing that. We did, from the consultant that the NDPER staff did hire, a Deloitte consultant, they did what's called a disruption of report. This is a very routine report when companies change insurance carriers, and it identifies who's in their network based on utilization and who's in our. We have some onesie twosies left over, a lot of chiropractors in there in the north. Western region of the state that we have to resolve and finish contracting with. We have some that we've never offered a contract to before because they've never seen one of our patients historically, and therefore they've just never had the need to have a contract in place with us. So we are continually working that. This is a risk-based contract, so whatever we fail to negotiate and finalize before July 1 is our risk. because ND PERS did write into the contract that we have with ND PERS that we honor the existing PPO network, which means the member cannot feel an impact if they go to a provider that historically was at the PPO network level and that we have failed to negotiate. That is our risk. And so that was very diligent on the part of the ND PERS board to outline that and again put that risk on us. So like I said, we're diligently working on it, which only makes it more imperative that what we offer is mutually agreeable, because it's in both of our interests to get it done fairly timely.
Mr. Chairman?
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Carlson, I just received some information from one provider that they were going to receive substantially less than they had received under the Blue Cross, and actually substantially less even than what Medicaid pays. And I know you mentioned that in some cases they're going to be reimbursed more. In general, what would you say it looks like across the board, average-wise? Are we going to be the same type of reimbursements? Are you looking at trying to keep it lower, or what would you say to that question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vigasau, we priced the bid based on our current contracts as best we can. Now, we don't know what Blue Cross Blue Shield pays our providers. However, we have done an independent market analysis using MedPAR data, which is basically data mining from consultants from filed Medicare statements that all the providers are required to do. And to that, we've used that to set our baseline so that we are trying to come in. That helps us come in at the right offer point, because again, we're trying to do this expeditiously. So if we're way off base, that just prolongs the process and is creates administrative workload and burden for our staff. So we engaged in a consultative report to help identify the baseline. And then there's levers that we have within that. So we put the initial offer out. It is not a take it or leave it offer. We expect providers to give us feedback. Some of these areas, again, if we've never done business in northwestern Minnesota, we may need a little help fine-tuning our bid and our code, but we do not expect providers, or when they do call us and say, I got XYZ codes that you're paying me X percent less than my other primary payer, we say, well, yeah, but did you look at XYZ codes? Because we're paying you, what do you think your analysis is of that? Well, yeah, you're right, you are paying me. So that's the back and forth is, we are not going to be able to replicate Blue Cross Blue Shield's payment. However, in aggregate, it should be hopefully a budget neutral transition for our providers. Our goal is not to disrupt provider payment or to significantly impact adversely the payment for all the NDPERS people that they are treating today. But that being said, I cannot replicate what they have today. So I have to start somewhere, and it is a give and take negotiation process.
Representative Carlson, do you have a question, comment?
I'm trying to think how to phrase it here. There was some discussion early on about the commitment that everything would remain exactly the same for 1 year. Is that anywhere written in the contract that everything will remain as much as possible the same for 1 year of the as it was with the Blues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the contract that and the RFP as it was bid was benefit coverage and design does not change. And you had some opening comments today stating that our goal here from the House side was to make sure that coverage is the same for all the members. That's everyone's goal, Sanford Health Plan's goal as well. Provider contracts do not affect member coverage. They don't affect their co-pays. They don't affect the benefits that they have. So it's kind of like we were told to make a cake. We were told what the end product of the cake needs to look like. We have to meet member satisfaction standards. We have to meet NDPERS performance guarantees, or we're going to lose the contract throughout all of this process. But we have our own formula and recipe for making the cake. And our formula and recipe for making the cake doesn't affect member coverage, and we acknowledge that. We're going to do it a little differently, but it won't affect the overall end cake. Is going to be what you ordered.
Well, if I can, Mr. Chairman,
continue.
The reason for this was more than anything, not for the individual, but to protect the other providers that are not part of your system. I mean, if you look at the amendment is quite clear, saying you've got to pay these people what you pay yourself. Now, I understand there's give and takes, and you might be low on one and high on the other one. Is there any language that you could give me a little comfort level with as to what your process is, how you deal with these other providers that are not part of your system? Because this is who that's for. It isn't for, because we understand that when my card goes in and I have a copay and a deductible of X amount of dollars, I'm going to pay the same with you, I'm going to pay the same with whoever else has the plan. The question is, we're still trying to protect not only the individual, but the other providers in the state that are not part of your system and part of the Sanford family. And I think we have that obligation as legislators to do that. So I'd be willing, Mr. Chairman, to look at just some kind of language that says how you do the process. You don't have to tell me what your rates are or how you derive it. But we want them to have a comfort level that they're going to be treated fairly out there and that we significantly looked at this issue when we did it. We've already, in the first part, talked about the firewall and the privacy, and I was glad to hear that really has buy-in from the Insurance Commission and from you folks saying, you know, we do that already. Well, that's good. But I think that it's important to make sure that in good, fair negotiations, when you have the hammer, you would rather be a rubber mallet instead of a sledgehammer. And we'd like to make sure that that was the process, and that was part of the reason for this. Because we knew the language was too broad, saying everybody's got to be given the same amount of money. And obviously the psychologists have sent 1,000 emails in the last few days how their rates are significantly less under your reimbursement rate than before, but maybe something else is higher. And I don't know that. But I do want to give them a comfort level that they are going to have a certain process that may or may not be in the contract with the rest of our providers around the state. And there's a lot of small ones that aren't part of the system.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I appreciate your comments. I would add to it that Sanford Health is not everything to everyone, nor are we in every corner of the state. Sanford Health particularly does not have chiropractors. We certainly don't have nursing homes in every nook and cranny. We don't have enough mental health providers. We don't have them where we need them. A little stress over there. Representative Carlson, so while Sanford cannot because we are not everything to everyone, I can't ensure that I'm not in that specialty, so we wouldn't know necessarily what to offer, which is why we rely on external data, and more importantly, why we rely on the provider feedback of our initial offer. That being said, we negotiate thousands of contracts of which services are not even provided in the state. Transplant, burn center units, brain trauma, just to name a few, are things that often go outside of the state because an immense amount of other subspecialties, when there is no one here that performs those services. And so there's an additional complexity to those services as well across our broad spectrum of payment methodologies.
Okay.
Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Chairman Wardner and Lisa. Who sets your standards for rate setting? Is there state or federal standards for the rate setting process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hogan, there is no state standards for rate setting. And so again, we rely on independent market analysis as well as our provider feedback, as well as how are we going to sell anything if we don't have the providers in the network that people need? And that is, to be honest, one of the biggest decision factors when we're trying to sell in areas where we can't sell in this. We cannot sell to XYZ company when the local community hospital is not in the network. So you basically carved out from our sales team, who never likes to hear that, they can't quote in this area until we can secure a contract. And so we very much control our own destiny by ensuring and acknowledging we compete against Medica. We compete against Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota. They have everyone in the network. That is our competition and our driving force.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Thank you. All right, committee members, if we're ready, we're going to move on to Section 8, which I think is not a big issue, but would you go over that one anyway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. We're changing gears a little bit here with Section 6, Sections 8, 9, and 10. You'll notice that we're not codifying these in the Century Code. They will go in the session laws, so they do have the force and effect, at least for the biennium. One of the things I want to bring to your attention in the memorandum you have in Section 8, I inserted the wrong dates here. I said that this applies through the end of the 15-17 biennium. That conflicts with the actual language of Section 8, where it says this section applies through the end of the current biennium. And what this is intended to do is, just in that Section 8, is to catch the application from with the emergency clause until the end of the biennium. So my mistake on that. Before I go into it, there's also a couple things I'd like to address. Not just what's here in 8, 9, and 10, but what's not in here in 8, 9, and 10. And there are two things that have come to my attention is, first, this bill doesn't have an application clause or something in the codified language clarifying what contracts or on what date this would apply. You know, that's pretty common. We usually don't do that. The items in this legislation, this proposed legislation, are going to be scrutinized quite carefully, and it's probably especially important that everybody recognize what contract it's going to apply to. Is there a risk of it disrupting a contract? Is it going to change the premiums or the cost of the contract? So as you move forward, something to think about is, do you want to put dates in the codified language, or do you want to add a section on the end that says application, make sure everyone's perfectly clear that this is how it will apply? So it's not in here. Might want to, you know, put it on your list of things to consider.
Would that be for the entire bill or just sections?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I would say you'd probably want to address any section in this bill that you think needs clarification of what is it going to apply to. And then the second thing that's not in here is, you know, we all know the history of this. This discussion began in House Bill 1475. And now we've got this vehicle. In 1475, there was a section that clarified that bill was not subject to the body of law that gives powers and duties to the Employees Benefit Programs Committee. This piece of legislation doesn't include that. I'm not saying that it's necessary that it has that. I think at the end of the day, the Act, whatever piece of legislation went through your actions, clarifies if you don't have it go before the Employee Benefit Programs Committee. By your actions, you've clarified that that's not necessary. So I think either way you're okay. Might it be nice to close that discussion a little bit? Maybe, especially because that body of law we're talking about has a provision that says any legislation enacted in contradiction of this section is invalid and of no force and effect, and any benefits provided don't apply. It might be nice to kind of close that off and just say, we knew what we were doing, we were perfectly aware of that, and we chose not to. Again, that's up to you whether you choose to insert language like that. There, having said that, let me go to Section 8 for you, okay? Section 8 provides that from the effective date of this act, remember there's a proposed emergency clause on here, from the effective date of the act, from when it's filed with the Secretary of State until the close of this biennium, if the PERS board determines that they would want to rebid that health insurance contract, this would authorize the current carriers, so in this case it would allow Blue Cross Blue Shield to continue to provide the policy for up to 90 days while it went through the rebid process. So that's what Section 8 does here. And it is subject to the emergency clause in Section 10.
Any comments about that? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Sparb can answer that. What would be the standard procedure today? Is it 12 months or is it done the day the biennium's over? And that's just from an ignorance point. I don't understand how that works, whether it be extended or not extended automatically for X amount of months or...
Right.
On the contract, whether it's extended?
Yeah. If it goes out for rebid, like this says.
What we normally do when we rebid is, I mean, that would start next year. So we have, you know, that would start a year before the end of the biennium. Now, this, of course, is a special circumstance that is being talked about here. Mm-hmm. Where it says it be determined the carrier providing the coverage at that time. Because, man, I missed that date. This is just for at the end of this biennium. So this would only apply, right, to this biennium?
Yep.
So this is just saying this time we'd have 9 months to be able to negotiate, which we would probably be.
That seems to make sense. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else on that? If not, we're going to move on to Section 9, the Reserve Fund.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as I review this, obviously, you've got the provision in your memorandum. But as I review it, I'm going to look to my left at our fiscal staff. So if you've got any additional questions on that, I'm going to rely on them to fill you in here. Again, this would not be codified in the Century Code. And this applies during our upcoming biennium for the 15-17 biennium. I guess I'm not sure how to read this together because it also indicates it's subject to the emergency clause. So I should probably revise what I said in the memorandum is that this applies from the effective date of this act through the end of the upcoming biennium, through the 15-17 biennium. And it indicates that it restricts the PERS board. It says they can't spend any of that money in the reserve fund to cover a gap and increase in the insurance premiums beyond the rates used by the 64th Legislative Assembly for developing their agency budgets.
Okay. Brady, did everybody get that? Did you get that to everybody? I think it's important that we kind of go over this reserve fund. I guess I learned a lot about it. And Brady, would you go through the reserve fund a little bit with us so everyone knows how it works?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. In section 5452.106, there is established a reserve fund for any refunds, rebates, dividends, or experience rating allowances, discounts, or other reductions of a premium amount which relate to the group health insurance program. And the funds may be used to reimburse the administrative expenses relating to the plan. And the money in the fund can also be used as to allow the option for the PERS board or the Legislative Assembly to change to a self-insured health insurance plan, reduce the premium rates charged to agencies, basically a premium buy-down, or to cover increased premiums during an interim in the event a federal or state health insurance mandate would require additional premium increases beyond the amounts anticipated by the Legislative Assembly. Monies in the fund are accumulated as a result of some cost-sharing provisions. And in the second part of the memorandum, it goes over those provisions. And first of all, if the premiums paid exceed the claims paid, PERS receives 50% up to the first $3 million and 100% for any amounts over $3 million. However, if premiums paid are less than the claims paid, then PERS pays 50% of the losses up to $6 million, and any losses over $6 million are paid by the health insurance carrier. There is a slight delay in the accounting for each of the amounts of the cost sharing, and that's just as a result of insurance claims coming in after the close of the fiscal year. But if you go towards the bottom of the memorandum on the first page, you can see the health insurance reserve fund balance, and you can see that in 2007 it was $1.5 million, and then it increased slightly during the 2009 and 2011-13 biennium, and then as a result of kind of an unusual situation, it did increase to $42 million on July 1st, 2013, and that was due to a settlement amount due to claims being substantially lower than anticipated during the biennium, so that resulted in that large increase. An example of the use of the reserve fund can be found at the bottom of the first page. And for the 2013-15 binding, PERS did use $10.9 million of its overall reserve funds to buy down the health insurance premiums paid by state agencies by approximately 2%. And money for that buy-down did come from the health insurance reserve fund, as well as a separate fund called the Early Retiree Reinsurance Program. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop there, but I'll stand for any questions on the insurance reserve fund.
All right. Any questions, comment? Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming that the contract, the language we had with the Blues is the same with Sanford on the same percentages? Okay.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman and Brady, so say this was frozen for 2 years. What impact would that have on any of the business we were doing in terms of the employees?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lee, I guess the major impact would be if there was an unforeseen event that would cause a change in the health insurance premium rate level. The increases in that rate level could not be paid from this fund.
And the funds would come from where then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lee, I guess it wouldn't be designated where those funds would come from.
Okay. Representative Carlson, you have...
He needs to be more specific, because we have a bid for X amount of dollars per month, per person, per plan for the biennium. That's the amount of money we funded. Before, we've used that money to buy down. If the increase is too high, we've used some of it to buy it down. Where's the option for it to go up when you already have a signed contract and you have an X amount of dollars per month?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, perhaps there would be a federal mandate that was unknown at the time that the legislature was meeting or was unanticipated that would cause the rate to increase. That could be one example. And I guess I'm not really sure of any other examples of that issue.
Well, I would need to know personally more if there was... What would be those examples where you'd have to, because you've set the premium, you've set the dollars, everything is organized. It was less than we anticipated from the last biennium. It was less than the bid by the other company. So we have budgeted $254 million for the biennium, for the health coverage for all of our employees. And I'm having trouble figuring out, other than a federal, something that had happened with the Not So Affordable Care Act, that what else there would be. I don't understand what else would be out there.
Well, go ahead, Senator Lee.
Would it be if there was an exceptional amount of claims being paid for some reason that, you know, these cost-sharing features wouldn't be able to cover?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lee, I guess I'm not sure how the reserve fund would work in that situation as it relates to the cost-sharing provisions. I believe PERS would have to respond to that question.
Yeah, come up there. I want to make a comment before you do. First of all, it's my understanding they signed a contract. They can't be raising any premiums for the next 2 years. That's a done deal. It's over. And the only thing that can change that is if you have some kind of a federal or state mandate that adds to it. But I would like to point out that when this is the part that I zeroed in on. If the premiums paid are less than the claims paid, that means if all of a sudden a lot more claims are paid out and the insurance company underbid and they're going to end up paying more claims, There is a clause in code that says PERS pays 50% of the losses up to $6 million. So that, let's say there was. So PERS has to pay $3 million. However, I'd like to point out we're looking at a $30 million savings. So it just doesn't, so if it happens, it happens. But the insurance company is still on the hook because they have to pay after that $6 million. Okay.
You're correct. Barb. That's correct. That's one of the advantages of the fully insured contract that we have today, is that the risk is transferred from the state of North Dakota to the carrier. when PERS was self-funded back in the 80s and we had claims running higher than expected. The PERS plan, the state of North Dakota had that risk. The PERS plan went broke and, you know, we didn't pay it. Now that, underneath the contract that we've developed with Blue Cross Blue Shield that now Sanford has, that risk is transferred to them. Now, what might change in between here? I can't think of anything that has substantially changed at any time in the past, so let me just give you some speculation. The AC, you know, a federal law comes along and says we have to cover something starting January of some period. That's not in the contract with Sanford. We'd have to go back and renegotiate the contract to cover that. And that would probably be an increase in premiums. Number two, the PERS plan, for example, the grandfathered PERS plan, the non-grandfathered does, but the grandfathered PERS plan does not cover birth control. PERS has never covered birth control under the grandfathered plan. The non-grandfather does because federal law requires it. That, of course, has been going through courts all over the country. It's not right now in our particular district, but if a court decided that, hey, you got to cover it, that's about $6 per contract per month. That would go when on in between the time that we negotiated, we'd have to go back to Sanford, renegotiate, and they'd come up with probably $6 per month, and we'd have to pay the extra. Now, that said, a lot of times when federal laws changes or when some of these things occur, a lot of times they recognize this and they say that effective with your next contract, you have to do it, not just plunk it down in the middle. So does this limitation, it would, unless something very, very unexpected occurs, we would be okay.
Okay, anyone else have any? Senator Heckerman.
I'd just like to ask Barb on the use of those reserve funds. In the 13-15 biennium, we used about $11 million to buy down health insurance premiums. Is that authority given to you in statute, in your board policy, just your board choice, or is it in administrative rules anyplace?
It's in statute.
Statute? Okay.
And that's something, I mean, when we come forward, you know, and the executive office reviews it, that's something that's acknowledged that, look, you know, here, your premium this year is going to be this, but it's 2% less than what's necessary. And, of course, then we want to make sure that's generally understood because the next time, that 2% you got to make up. I mean, you know, that's not a permanent reduction. That's a one-time reduction. So next time your thing starts from there forward. So
we and was that consistent? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Can I continue?
Continue.
Was that consistent over every state agency, or were there certain state?
It goes across all of our contract base because all of our contract base contributes to it. So it's the state political subdivisions and retirees that benefit from it.
Okay, anyone else have any questions for Sparb while he's up here on that issue?
There was one about what happens if something did come up and we don't have, where would the funds come from? Since there is no funds, we'd have to cut benefits. So what would happen?
Okay, thank you. Okay. Jennifer, does that bring us just about to the end?
Chairman, it does. The remaining section is Section 10, and that's your emergency clause for Sections 7, 8, and 9. As it relates to this bill, it means that those provisions would become effective upon filing of the bill with the Secretary of State.
Okay, we've gone through the whole procedure, and we've taken a look at it, and I guess we are going to take a break, and then we'll come back after lunch and make some conclusions to this meeting. But I'll make some comments right now. Might as well get it on the table. As far as the policy parts, I think the Senate still is in the same position they were. We think that in this discussion today, there were some merited things in there that you brought up. I think that they need to look in at. But I don't think this is the time of the bill to put them in. We would like to see the budget bill passed by the legislature and move forward. But we think that these things can wait, the ones that probably need some attention. And I will have to say this, that as I listen to what's going on, I think PERS did a pretty good job of vetting this thing. I think they put Sanford through the paces. I think they kept a short leash on them. I really do. Now, with that being said, we can always improve, and when we talk about the PBM and the audits there, I think that needs to be looked at. I also think that you make some good points about membership on the PERS board. I think that should be looked at. But not right now. And I think that some of these other things that we've talked about, I think Sanford at least should have the opportunity to show whether they're going to perform or not. They haven't had a chance. The starting gun is not fired for them yet. So that's kind of where we're at. And when we come back, I would like to, we can go through and just kind of make some discussion and some comments from the House, and then we'll wrap it up this afternoon. So with that, Representative Carlson, any comments? And then we're going to take a break, and we'll be back at 12:45 is what we're going to do.
We'll talk after lunch.
All right. We're going to take a one-hour break, and we will be back at 12:45. What I'd like to do is allow the House leadership to make some comments and talk about, I would imagine, kind of go through the parts again, the ones that we discussed. So, Representative Carlson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been trying to think of the right comments to make after your comments right before lunch. And I can tell you that there are still some significant differences between the two chambers. And I'll just kind of go through these section by section, and I'll give you some recommendations, and then you can do as you will with them. And I think that'll determine where our future is on this particular issue. If you look at the budget itself, most of the things that the Senate asked for, the House acceded to those, and they were changed. And all the money that we had removed pretty much was all put back in. So as far as the monetary issues, the House came way across the line on those and took care of those issues. So I don't think that is a point of contention for us. As far as Section 3, or Section 4, where it talks about the retirement board, here I'll give you a recommendation. You can write it down and see what you think. We still believe that it's a real conflict to have the Attorney General, who is to represent us on issues and gives opinions on legality of things, that he should not be on there as designee, as well as a regulator for these institutions should be on there. But we would still recommend removing those two, and instead of having four legislators, that the number be two, so the size of the board remains the same. So that would take care of Section 4. I got to follow along here as we go to make sure I got too many pieces of paper here. Section 5 of the bill, it talks about the contract, and the term of the contract may not exceed 2 years. The PBMs, we want that. We believe that that is a great big issue, but we also, Mr. Chairman, agree that that issue is too big to take on at this point in time. If we believe that Lafferty should get into that issue, I think we have that opportunity later, so we would recommend that issue be removed from the bill. Section 5 would be gone. Section 6, I still believe there should be some clarification. We would concede that the contract may not exceed 2 years. We think that the language that they had in the RFP probably could be expanded. It said the contract will be for 6-year term with 2-year renewals. I think we should codify to some extent what that means and what would constitute the fact that that would be taken to bid by the PERS board. I don't have any exact language for that, but that section could be removed. If they wanted to add something to clarify the bidding process, then I think that we could do that in that section. Section 7 creates a new section of law specific to the PERS board contract for health insurance benefits. I believe both sides, both the people that we asked said that that was, they felt that language was okay. And we would recommend Section 1 in. We do think that when we heard from Sanford, their discussion about the rates and the discounts and things, that section, subsection 2, could go away. I think there was a logical argument for that. Section 8, the question there would have been, is this valid if in fact somebody had to rebid prior to June 30th, because this section was only good till June 30th. The question is whether or not it's valid to leave it in there because of the short period of time in between there. And that one could stay or go. It does not mean that much to us. And the last one, I think it's important that that money be used. A bid is a bid, like you said, Mr. Chairman. And I do think that that would be valuable to be left in there. We would support that. We thought that was very important going in, and we still think that's important, that a bid is a bid, and that we have accepted those numbers on the face value of what they are. There's been discussion, Mr. Chairman, that this bill was the same bill that was 1475. It's not even close. There are two issues that are still burning in a lot of legislators and people's minds, and they're not in this bill. We don't ask them to be in the bill. Number one is the provider network. If you remember, we had discounts that were set for in-state and out-of-state, and the amount of participation they had to have by those, though that issue was gone. But the issue that I still get calls on is the prior authorization one, and that is not in here. We have a lot of people. In fact, the Speaker of the House is right now with his wife at Mayo waiting for hopefully a lung transplant to keep her alive, and she has to stay there because of her health condition. So there are people that have used it, want to continue to use it, would like to have the opportunity to use it, but we did not include those kind of things in this bill. We think that with the things that I just gave you, that the House would be, we would be able to have a discussion with our colleagues and get those things passed through the House chamber. Quite honestly, if we came back with nothing other than the budget, I don't believe we have any chance whatsoever of that passing in the House, and therefore I believe would be really of no value to us to call ourselves back in to have a special session or a continuation of our session. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the comments that we have, that I have regarding the bill and the sections that are in the bill. We've taken out some of the crucial items. We've left in a few things that are important, that we think are very important in terms of protection and firewalls. Even though it's quite generic, we believe that it does not affect the sharing of information because it does deal with healthcare providers, and we think that the language is good. I would, as I said, I would not hesitate to, if we could put some language in to clarify the bidding process as to how we believe that should go. I think that would be something that would be valuable. And, Mr. Chairman, that's where we are at this point in time from the House's perspective.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to do just a quick review of these things to make sure that I'm on the same page. Sections 1 and 2, which would be the budget, would be okay.
Yep.
Section, 3 is not relevant, but 4 you want to amend, remove 2 and add 2 legislators.
Yep.
The section 5 on the PBMs, you would agree to remove that.
Yep.
Section 6, the length of contract, you just want that language codified. Is that what you're asking? And that would be,
I think we should clarify the process as to what constitutes a rebid, from our perspective, and
because right now the RFP says the contract will be for a six-year term with two-year renewals beginning July 15th, and that's what it says. I mean, what constitutes them? I mean, it might be in the total contract they signed, but it's sure not in the RFP.
Right.
And, right. And I think that should be clarified so we, even as legislators, know what that process is. I mean, are we going to go back every 2 years? Obviously, we haven't done it in the past. And I do understand that if you're going to invest in, and Sanford has invested in people and in buildings and rent, that you need a commitment long enough, but there needs to be a reason, an explanation why you want to have that renegotiated. And it should be specific, I believe. Because otherwise, it might in the future, that language could have kept future bidders out of the game. And I don't think that was our intention, Mr. Chairman.
No, it wasn't. But I'm going to ask for some, I have some questions about that particular issue. So, Sparb, in just a second, I want you to answer them. Section 2, which was to do with the negotiation with Priders, you said that would be removed. And then Section 8 was a rebid thing, remove. And then Section 9, the reserve fund, would you, and you, I've got keep down, and what would you go through your comments on that again? The reserve fund is, in the way it's in the bill, is it's for 2 years. That's freezing the reserve fund.
Yep, it's just for the next two biennium, or the next biennium.
Yeah, this yes. Coming biennium.
Yep.
Okay. All right. I would like, I'll tell you what's going to happen here. I want some questions answered, and we're going to take a break. And we're going to talk about it amongst our group over here so that you know what's coming up. So I would like to go to Sparb, and would you come up, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Section 6, codifying the language. And I assume, Representative Carlson, could you kind of lead him along on what you're thinking on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, more than anything, I'd like to have what he has as a process that appears to show up in the contract, but not in the RFP, as to the procedure that will, what would trigger a rebid. If you're giving somebody a six-year contract, I think there should be a reasonable expectation of what triggers a rebid after 2 years. And there should be a list of things that the board would look for and would use and make their decision based on that. I mean, if I was bidding it, I'd want to know, is it just because you don't like the way I smiled today and we're going to rebid it? Or are there reasons, physical reasons, why you had to do it? And I don't think it's very clear in their RFP, and I think it should be understood by us as well what could justify a rebid if we see it and say, you know, you should be rebidding this because.
Turn your mic on, so.
Those could be identified. I mean, essentially what they are is that if the premium renewal is deemed by the board to be too high, in other words, the renewal, we believe we could go to market and get a better opportunity. So one is premium, and then the second one is performance that can drive it. And when we talk about performance, we're talking about the whole range of issues. So that would be easy. That can be identified here, and it would identify what the two factors. And then, of course, as long as we could have the what I always call the catch-all, such other issues as the board deems appropriate, because there are things that come up that you don't necessarily anticipate that are not workable. So, you know, that those are the two main variables that we look at. And then, of course, as we look at performance, we have in the bid, which is now in the contract, we have a series of performance standards that we have expectations on. and there are actually penalties that are built around those performance standards. So we can, under performance, we can take those performance standards and say, including, you know, I mean, this is responsiveness on the call centers, you know, these various things that we have that are outlined in the contract that are there, that are part of performance. Another part of performance that we look at is just general response that we get from our members. I mean, I've had situations where, well, we have one today where we have one carrier that is meeting all the performance standards. They're turning things around timely. They're good for our office to work with. But we just haven't gotten over a threshold where our members have embraced them. So sometimes it may come down to, you know, your rates are fine, your performance is fine, but our members just...
Customer satisfaction isn't.
Customers just aren't.
Or whatever.
I mean, so sometimes things set in to things like that. So yes, those could be identified, and I could just identify the things we do consider right now.
Well, Representative Carlson, what I want to ask is the words performance, premium, are those words that you would be okay with?
Yeah, I think it adds some clarity to the questions we as legislators ask. Why didn't you rebid it? Why did you rebid it? And it gives them some criteria that's put in language that says, you have a 6-year contract, all right, but if these things happen, we are going to go back to rebid. And if a legislator or the legislative management looks at it and says, Mr. Chairman, we need to, there's something not right here, we've got to have this rebid, and we should send a note to PERS saying they should do this because we don't believe it's meeting this expectation, I think that now we both have a background to do that.
And I clarify, we only give them a 2-year contract.
2-year contract?
And then with options to renew it so that we don't get hung up in contractual things.
So Sparb, you have no problem with that, and you would come up with language that would...
I can work with legislative staff.
Well, okay.
Help draft something, certainly.
All right. Okay, let's... I want to go one more time, and then I got... Besides you, I got a couple other people I want to check with. Again, make sure. Firewall, HIPAA. I want to ask you, do you have any problem with that? Leaving that language in there? Everybody says they're doing it anyway. It doesn't matter.
I would agree with that everybody, that a lot of those things are doing. But just to give you an idea that under treatment, payment, and operations, this is HIPAA language. HIPAA does carve out some exceptions to treatment, payment, and operations, just so you know that. And of course, you have one variable in there that this isn't. It's related and unrelated healthcare entities. HIPAA does it by others. For example, HIPAA has a exception on that that says if it's required by another law, we can do it. If it relates to public health activities, which may be county nursing, things like that. They're not necessarily what you think is a health-related activity or a healthcare activity, but they are, in a sense, and they're not part of the formal ones. If it has to do with dealing with victims of abuse, neglect, or domestic violence, you know, if there's something that comes up relating to that, there's a carve-out that's beyond treatment, payment, and operations. It may involve sharing with a related healthcare entity. Judicial or administrative proceedings, we may get called upon to share. I think that would be outside law enforcement purposes. You know, if there's somebody in a prison or something like that. Decedents, sharing information with funeral directors, sharing information maybe with another related or unrelated healthcare for organ transplants or tissue donations. And then I think we covered research. And then if there's a serious threat to health or safety is another carve-out that falls outside those treatment, payment, and operations. So these are unusual circumstances, but these are things that that HIPAA recognizes are outside treatment, payment, and operations.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. I was just having a sidebar with Ms. Clark here, and she has an idea of how you could add on to that to make sure that you cover that area.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, if I understand you correctly, Ms. Sparb, you just said we've got a broad statement here in this bill draft, and we don't recognize some of the exceptions that HIPAA recognizes. In our conversation with my conversation with Representative Carlson, one of the things we talked about is perhaps we could keep that broad statement and then say, unless expressly authorized by the PERS board to address issues such as, and then have illustrative list of domestic violence, state law, public health, you know, kind of give you that framework, but then it doesn't lock us into the HIPAA exemptions. It leaves it to the board to say that, yeah, we've identified an authorized release.
That makes sense to me.
Okay. Any comments from anyone else? Okay, thank you. And then I would like the insurance department to, you heard what was said. You're the one that has to regulate all this, so what do you think?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rebecca Ternest, again, from the insurance department. Yeah, and I'm looking at 26.1-36-12.4, which is our confidentiality of medical information. And again, specifically, probably subsection 3, which says, may not be construed to prevent disclosure necessary for an insurer to conduct utilization review or management consistent with standards imposed by another section, to facilitate payment of claim, to analyze health plan claims or healthcare records data, to conduct disease management, or to reconcile or verify claims under a shared risk or capitation agreement, does not apply to data or information disclosed as a part of biomedical research, nor may this section be construed to limit the insurance commissioner's access to records of the insurer for the purposes of enforcement or other activities. So, and it kind of goes on. But I think, if I heard what Ms. Clark said, you mentioned state law, correct? So that would be covered.
Okay. Any questions for Rebecca before she leaves? She's in the back row and has to struggle to get out.
I'll move to the front again. Sorry about that.
That's right.
Thank you.
I would like a representative from Sanford to step up and just make comment about that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sanford Healthline would support such language.
Okay, thank you. All right. All right, let's move to Section 9, the Reserve Fund. And that one, that's simply, that's a two-year.
Yep, just for this biennium.
Okay. Sparb, I need...
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, just as a point of make sure we're on the same page here. The wording in this, as it says, is that the reserve fund could not be used for buying down premiums.
Right.
And that's the way I understand that. Keep in mind, though, that the this we call it reserve, but it's kind of an operating fund that's set up underneath there. Within that operating fund, some office administrative costs are paid for through that, some of these things. This doesn't restrict, in our interpretation, those functions that we normally would do.
That would be a red flag, and you're just checking to see whether it does or not.
Right.
I don't think that was the intent, but I would like Representative Carlson to...
I thought that's what you had a budget for.
Yeah, but where the money comes from for the budget...
it doesn't appear to show up that way in here.
Is from PERS operating funds. Just
Alan, any thoughts on that, how that shows up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, really, the section was meant, I believe, to indicate, you know, the premium rate for this next biennium is the $1,130, and it was meant to ensure that is going to be the rate, that there would be no increase above that, and PERS could not use the reserve fund to keep it at that level, yet change the plan.
I'm okay with that, and we wouldn't restrict other uses they've had in the past for it.
Right.
Okay, I have no trouble with that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Let's go back. Okay, we've got those. Let's talk a little bit more about 4. You're talking about removing 2 and adding 2. And as far as the legislators, which ones were you thinking of?
I wouldn't dare list any names, Mr. Chairman.
I wasn't thinking of names. I mean, there's...
I would leave the designee of the leader of each chamber to pick who that representative would be on there. That would have been my language, and the other members would be taken off.
Okay. That's what I needed to know.
Yep.
Committee members, any more? We're going to be taking a... We're going to take a 15-minute break here in a couple of minutes. Any comments or questions before we do that? If not, we're in recess until 25 after. Bring the committee back to order. We do have one question before we start going through the different items. In Section 9, SPARB, the Health Insurance Reserve Fund limitations, and it talks about other programs, insurance, uniform group insurance programs and so forth. Could you comment on that? Are we affecting something that we don't mean to affect if we leave that language the way it is?
Well, it would be clearer just to specify that it relates to the health insurance plan. Now, we don't have what we call participating contracts on the dental, the vision, the life insurance anymore. Participating, incidentally, just means that we get money back if it comes in below. We have, like in the life insurance plan, we pay a premium, period. Dental, we pay a premium, period. And there's no of this reconciliation. We don't have any other participating, so we wouldn't be affecting. We do have $1.8 million. I don't know if that was identified there. Is that in that? We have $1.8 million that's in from when our life insurance plan was a participating contract that we've been holding for years and years since it hasn't been allocated to anything.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, we were discussing that same thing, and Alan, I think, came up with a little clarifying language that you could write on. If you went to that sheet in the bill, I believe it's on page 7 at the bottom, Alan, if you'd read through that section, Health Insurance Reserve Funds. It's on the blue. It'd be in the blue on page 7.
Yep. Yep. I got it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson and I had a discussion on the break as well, and the suggestion was maybe on line 22 to remove the other accumulated reserves and just say other source. That way it's just clear that, you know, that the premium rate is set for the next 2 years, and they can use any reserve fund or any other money that they may have available to buy down the premiums.
So your language change would be any...
Or any other source on line 22, and then we'd remove accumulated reserves under the uniform, and then on to line 23, group insurance program.
Okay. One other question, Sparb. We got one more question for you.
The
emergency clause that's in the bill, is that needed anymore?
Well, I think I'd leave that probably to council, but probably not.
Okay.
This is an appropriations bill, so an appropriations bill is going to become effective on July 1. So, you know, an emergency clause at this point would just make it effective a few days earlier.
Yeah.
But
that's
no
big deal to us.
Yeah, we can. So that Section 10 probably isn't needed. So, okay. Section 9, the reserve fund. We're okay with that. Leave it with the language corrections and stuff. We're okay. Section 8, the rebid to remove, we're okay with that. Section 7, subsection 2, which deals with negotiations with providers, it's removed and we're okay with that. Section 7, subsection 1, the firewall and the HIPAA regulations and the language that's in here, we're okay with that. Section 6,
The length of the contract, putting it in code, the way it's spelled out now, we're okay with that. Section 5, the PBM, remove, we're okay with that. And we are not in agreement on number 4. We are in agreement on, I don't know, 3 matters, but 1 and 2, we're okay with that. Number 4, I guess at some point, we don't have a, you know, we would be open to looking at changing the board, but I guess not in this particular piece of legislation. And I guess I would just like to make this comment. First of all, from what I've heard today and what I've seen previous to this, I think the board has done a great job. I think they, like I said earlier, I think they have held Sanford's feet to the fire. There was a vetting process that I think that they made sure way in advance that they were headed down the right trail. I don't think they did anything wrong, and so we're changing the board when I don't think that they did anything that I think they did a good job. And so to change the makeup of the board at this point, I think would be wrong. However, some of the arguments you make, I think, have some merit. And I do think maybe going forward, next session, we take a look at putting a couple of legislators on the board. But I don't know. I just see it as kind of a punishment for doing a good job at this point. And so those are my comments, and I'm open to other comments that disagree or agree. Representative Vigasa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, on that issue, are you more in disagreement with adding legislatures or more in disagreement with removing the 2 that were removed? What was your philosophy on those 2 issues?
Okay, thank you. Representative Vegas, I guess, first of all, removing would be the first number one. We would be really not in favor of that at all, especially when the board, I think, has done a good job. And the second thing, adding legislators, as I said, I would be, I'm open to that, but not on this bill. I mean, next session, we take a look at that, and you and Representative Carlson have made some points about PERS and the money they handle, and that maybe the legislature needs to be connected. But I would like a little more look-see at that before we made any decisions to do that. So, anyone else have any comments they would like to make?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to argue whether the board did a good job or a bad job, because when you're on a board, usually it's a thankless position, and no matter what you do, somebody can find a reason to criticize you for what you did. My logic always rests in the fact that the legislature, who pays $254 million in premiums, needs to have some involvement on the board. They should be knowledgeable people picked by you or I or the management that have some understanding of how insurance works, and they should be on that board as a participator. You could argue that we're meddling in the executive branch, but on the other hand, nobody exists around here without us paying for it. And when you only are told that this is what you're paying, and you have no connection, and you only hear about the fact that a contract is going to change by rumors in the hall, you got a problem, because that's $254 million and it grows every biennium and every biennium. Now, we believe the board, we should have some involvement. I still believe it's a conflict with the Attorney General's office. I mean, he just ruled an opinion on the very issue of this, but yet he sits on the very board that he's ruling the opinion on. I don't think that's right. I think it's wrong. And an agency that regulates the industry shouldn't be sitting on the board making decisions on the premiums. Now, I could live with them staying there for the next biennium, but I still firmly believe that the legislature needs to put two people on that board to have some involvement in our process. And let me tell you, I'll be the first one to introduce a bill next time, if this gets approved, to remove those two people from the board, because I believe it's a conflict of interest. I'm not sure who the Attorney General would defend if we'd had a lawsuit, or if we had questioned, and we had sued over his opinion on a continuing appropriations. Does he pick us, or did he pick PERS? Especially when his number two man is the guy sitting on the board that did the things that we didn't think that should have been done. So, I guess Representative Bigassaw and I, and I'm not sure where Representative Hogan is at, but I think we need some involvement on the board, and I would be willing to leave those two people on there and deal with the bill on that next time, but I do really firmly believe that we need some involvement on that board. And we would be willing to leave the two and add two legislators.
Just a comment on your comments. First of all, you know, the Attorney General is also on the Industrial Commission, and I think he rules out in the oil patch on issues that affect the state and are on the other side of the fence, too. So he does get himself in a lot of tight spots, no question about it, but that's the job. The other thing is, this particular PERS board saved the state $30 million. I guess it's not all state money. Some of it is private or pay. It's not, but it's 20 to 25 million, excuse me. If I said thousand, I meant million dollars. And so I guess, you know, they haven't done a bad job. They saved us some money. And I, like I said, I think that, and I don't have any problem with taking a look at changing those two members and putting somebody else on there. Because as we've talked, we wonder why the insurance commissioner isn't on there. Now, is the insurance commissioner a regulator that would regulate that? Is that why they're not on there? They'd be in the same position as the Attorney General in some cases. So, I guess we're, other than that particular section, we're in agreement with this thing to go. Anyone else have any comments? Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Senator Wardner. Representative Carlson asked my opinion. I think that if we leave the Attorney General and the Department of Health representatives to add two legislators would help build relationships. And much of the reason we're in this room today is because there was a breakdown in communication, and I don't think it would hurt to add those two. So I'm agreeing with him. I thought you'd laugh.
I'm thankful.
What's going on over there?
We just get along, you know. You'll probably get taken to the woodshed later. But.
Anyone else comments? We're going to take a 5-minute break. After some wrenching thinking, contemplating, the Senate would agree to two legislators, but we're going to ask that they be appointed by the chair of management. We think it's fair that there should be one from each party, is the way it was. So we would agree to the two legislators appointed by the chair of management.
Mr. Chairman will agree to that. Whether it be you or I or the chairman of management, it's somebody in leadership will be picking people who have a knowledge of the industry, and that would help.
Okay.
I'd like to add one more thing, Mr.
And we're in the, and we're keeping the two.
Yep. Okay. And we're keeping the two, but as long as we're dealing with that topic, why don't we also have the amendment drafted that said the health officer or his designee, so the person who's been illegal for the last few years will finally be legal?
Okay.
Because right now, all the votes she took were not according to statute. Huh? I don't, we have not found that anywhere. You'll have to find it, because I don't believe that is the way our statute reads, but...
Oh, we'll make sure...
We'll check to make sure that it's proper, so it's done right.
And I agree. Anyone have any other comments? Then that means that we have an agreement, a tentative agreement, to recommend to legislative management to reconvene the legislature to finish our business.
I would make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, is there a second to that?
Second.
Any further discussion? And after we vote, I have some comments, and Representative Carlson, you'll be welcome to make some too. Any further discussion on the motion? If not, we'll call the roll.
Senators Wardner.
Aye.
Heckman.
Aye.
Lee.
Aye.
Representatives Carlson.
Yes.
Hogan.
Yes.
Vigasa.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the motion carries.
I just want to make this comment. You know, I really didn't want to put anybody, any legislators on at this time. I think you guys made some good points that as we move forward, that I think there is some merit for it. I would like to have studied it a little bit more and looked at it. I know you might say, well, I don't know what's there to study. It's either up or down, but I still would have liked to have taken a longer look at it. But we have a responsibility in the state of North Dakota to do a job. The legislature has to, it's their job to pass the budget and not be someplace else. So I will tell you that in the context of doing the right thing, that's what we're doing, and we're looking forward to meeting, and that we will reconvene. We will have conference committees appointed when we get back, and they'll come right down here and get this stuff on, and we get this thing voted on and get them out of here in a short period of time. I will say that I was pleased with it today, both sides. I thought it was a very productive negotiations. And I appreciate that, and I just want every one of you to know that I appreciate the conduct, the professionalism, and the way this thing went down. And I appreciate the people that contributed from the audience. We needed that expertise in order to come to this decision. But I think that what we did here today is not only important for the state of North Dakota, for the PERS, but it's also important for the integrity of the North Dakota legislature, that we can get things done. So, thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You run a good meeting. And I think that anybody that had something to say today had the opportunity to say it. It helps, and I thank the staff that's here to give us a little guidance on the proper language and wording as we go. It is our job to pass the budget. It's not the budget. It's not the authority of the executive branch to have continuing appropriations. I'm still a little disappointed with the opinion. I think that that was a stretch at best. But it is our job, and we're going to come back and pass a budget. And this wasn't about, as much as the press who are sitting here like to talk about it's one side against the other, this was a matter of a differences of opinion that we had to work out. It took us a little longer than we'd like, but we had to work out the differences between the two chambers, and we did that. But this isn't about the Blues. This isn't about Sanford. This is about the hospitals and the clinics and the patients that go to those clinics and how well they're served across the state. That's what this is about. We're charged with paying for this, but it's about the quality of care that they get and the access to care that they get when it was all done. And I think in the end, we accomplished that means. And I'm looking forward to coming back. They won't get to call me 80-day Al, because we'll be done in 79 days. And it doesn't ring as well, 79-day Al, so that probably won't happen. But I'm looking forward, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming the process is that Senator Holmberg will call together a conference call of the management, and the management will make a motion to accept our report and forward it on to the legislature, and we'll be back here. And my understanding is it would be for next Tuesday. Is that correct?
Yes, Tuesday the 16th of June.
So again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for working through this and for the members of your committee. And Representative Hogan, Representative Vigasaw, thanks for working on this, because somebody had to come back and get this resolved, and I think the result was good.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Holmberg.
Just to notice, the we will be having a conference call of legislative management scheduled for 9 a.m. on Wednesday, and all members of legislative management will receive information on how to call in and where to call in. The focus of the meeting will be in this room. It will be in this room for members of the media that might be interested in watching telephones and people talk. The management will have a meeting then at 9 o'clock, and the motion that someone should make is that the legislature reconvene to finish its work on at 8 a.m. on June 16th.
All right. Before we break, I just want to make sure I second what Representative Carlson. Thank you, Legislative Council, for all your help and your work. We appreciate that. You're part of the process. You did a good job. Anyone else have any comments for the good of the order before we adjourn? And this will be sine die.
Again.
Okay. This committee, we don't expect this committee to meet again. So, motion for adjournment.
I'll make that motion.
All right, we got a motion. Is there a second? Okay, seconded by Senator Lee. Motion made by Representative Carlson. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned.
Something where we go over health insurance plan like we do with employees, the legislature.